Evening, ladies and gentlemen. My clock says 7:30, and I think it's time to start. It's a pleasure to welcome you to this second installment of this series on sudden cardiac death. And this evening, we will be dealing with the problem of cot death and the long QT syndrome. Yesterday, Dirk Blom gave a wonderful talk on a problem, actually, that should concern us all, which was that of the high cholesterol, the atherosclerosis, and the coronary disease, which can affect people right up to old ages in life. We're looking at the other end now of the life course, sudden death that occurs in infancy, as well as the long QT syndrome, which affects children, young adults, and perhaps could even be present in middle age. And it's a singular pleasure and honor for me to welcome my mentor and my collaborator, Professor Peter Schwartz, who comes from the University of Pavia in Milan, to be a speaker on this topic. Peter was born on the 29th of January 1943. I remember because he always makes sure I come to his house for his birthday party on that day. And this year, of course, because it was 1943, it's going to be the big one for him. He was born in Huntington, although, of course, originally from Italy, and it was because of problems of war at the time, and then went back to Italy, where he completed his education, graduated from the University of Milan in 1967 as a medical doctor, and then by about 1973 he was already a cardiologist, and has been worked in this field of cardiology for a very, very long time, working mainly on how the autonomic nervous system influences our lives and puts us at risk for dying suddenly, and has singularly pursued this topic of long QT syndrome from the very beginning. And really, in the world, he is Mr. Long QT Syndrome. It's impossible to think about this topic without actually thinking Peter Schwartz. So Peter, I think we are really honored to have the world's best speaker and the world's greatest authority on this topic of long QT syndrome as well as cot death talking to us this evening. Welcome to Cape Town.
Thank you, Bongani, for making it very difficult from the session. Good evening to all of you. I'm delighted being here. I can help making a comment that you made me blush mentioning my age. It was never been a problem for me, but the big seven, it's having an effect, probably, at least psychologically. You also mentioned my birthplace, Huntingdon, and usually, if that comes up, I add that I'm one of those expatriates who kept the passport and lost the accent. I was forced to move to Italy when I was a child, and that explains it. Anyway, you've seen the title of my talk, which really has to do with cot death or crib death or sudden infant death syndrome. It's never easy for a scientist to talk to a lay audience. I'll try to transmit my message and what I think about all this thing in not too technical terms. In a few points, I'll need your effort, but it will be minor. It's going to be a story of death and life and science and medicine and scientific fraud and manipulations made by money and some fruitful research. It's going to be a combined story. So let me start at once. Let's see if this is the right way. So let's start with the definition. What is sudden infant death syndrome? This is the sudden death of any infant which is unexpected by history and in which a post-mortem examination fails to demonstrate an adequate cause of death. It's fair to remind you that, with the exception of the first week in life, SIDS is the leading cause of mortality in the Western world. There are several issues that I wish to mention at the beginning that complicates research in SIDS. One is that SIDS investigators have different backgrounds and different areas of expertise. You have pathologists, epidemiologists, psychologists, expert in respiration, cardiologists, you name it. And the disease, as a consequence, is raising a lack of a common language. And when there is a lack of common language, what happens is that the theories of the accredited scientists and of the quack are alike to the eyes of the gullible beholder. Because if I'm told or shown slides coming from a microscopic examination, I can be easily fooled. And if I talk about some of my basic work, experts, let's say, in respiratory illness, will have some hard time in following me, and that is a problem. Another big issue is that SIDS is multifactorial. This means that an infant in the first 3-6 months of life can die because of many different causes. There is not a single cause of SIDS. Some of the causes are listed here. Clearly, the most important are respiratory mechanism and cardiac mechanism, but there are many others. And one should not forget that there is 5-7% of SIDS are related to infanticide. It's a terrible thing, but it cannot be dismissed immediately. This, by the way, is one of the reasons of the terrible psychological impact on the affected families. I mean, there are probably no other disease resulting in the death of a child that exerts such a devastating psychological impact on the families. It's a guilty feeling, especially in the mothers, because the mothers are incredibly connected to their babies, especially in the first year of life. So they feel responsible if something happens to them. Somehow they have not been able to save the child, even if there is no fault of them. And then there are suspicions, and people talk about it, and they wonder, what have you been doing? You've been listening to the TV, you've been making love, there were noise in the house, you might have been outside and not heard the baby crying. Actually, the rate of divorce among families suffering from SIDS is exceedingly high compared to the normal rates in any country. People move away, they don't want to live in the same neighborhood. Relatives don't help. Usually grandmothers are dreadful. Mothers-in-law are dreadful. In any case, there are a number of reasons. Now, the reason for me to bring this up is that even though any investigator may have his own pet theory, if you study a number of SIDS cases, they not necessarily will die because of one mechanism, so you just need to figure out how many die from a certain mechanism. And my interest in the entire thing was that I, at one point, as we will see, began to think that one of the mechanisms might have been avoidable. In other words, if all SIDS cases are unavoidable deaths, there is very little that can be done. My view is contrary to this. I do believe, and we have shown the evidence, as we will see at one point during my talk, that a certain percentage of sudden infant death syndrome cases are avoidable. Now, I'm coming to this slide to a concept that was brought about 50 years ago. Warren Gunterott was a very well-known and respected, for a while, pediatrician, who in 1963 made a sort of a revolutionary proposal. He suggested that the spectrum of sudden infant death syndrome should be broadened to include living infants who had been resuscitated from what otherwise would resemble sudden infant death syndrome. So he opened the possibility of an equation between a near miss and SIDS. What are the near misses? The near misses are the infants found by the parents, cyanotic, which means blue, apneic, not breathing, and probably going to die a few moments later. Then they are sort of rescued, rushed to the hospital, the baby leaves, and Gunterott's suggestion was that these near misses were the same thing as true sudden infant death syndrome victims. And there were reasons for that. The autopsy findings are indeed compatible with resuscitation. and the cyanotic and apneic infant with profound bradycardia can be expected to die. And it is also true that some near misses eventually die of SIDS. There was another reason for the equation. SIDS research up to that time was limited to the examination of a corpse. The equation of near misses to SIDS opened a new area of research, allowing many investigators to evaluate the parameters of their own interest in living SIDS infants and to publish their results as studies on SIDS. So his proposal was very much welcome in the field of pediatrics. And as a consequence of the equation, with the acceptance of the idea that near misses are an integral part of SIDS, apnea became the focus of research. And if infants die because they stop breathing, what would you like to know? You would like to know in advance if your infant stops breathing. So I have to bring up a name now, a name that will come back later on in my talk, and is the name of Pete Petit. He's usually regarded in Google as a business and philanthropist. In 1970, he founded Healthdyne, which is the apnea monitors company with sales up to $1 billion. Just remember his name, Pete Petit. Why were apnea monitors sold? Because if a baby dies because he's not breathing, then if you have a monitor that has an alarm and alerts you that the infant is not breathing, then you may come to the rescue and save the child. In 1972, there was another fundamental step. Pediatrics, the leading journal of pediatrics in the world, published this paper, and few scientific articles have had an impact as profound as this one. Alfred Stein Schneider was at the time working in Syracuse and moved to Baltimore, and his paper essentially described five infants in the same family who had a number of prolonged apneic and cyanotic episodes during sleep, some requiring vigorous resuscitative efforts. Two of the infants subsequently died of SIDS. As a matter of fact, all five infants in the study died of SIDS. The publication of this article led the National Institute of Health in the United States, which is the largest and most powerful funding agency in the world, to launch a program and put a lot of money available for research on sudden infant death syndrome. And that was, as you will see momentarily, became the connection with me, because when I became aware that there was money available for SIDS, I said, well, let's think about it. Anyway, this paper, again, was based on five infants with these episodes dying of SIDS. It took a long time, 20 years, when in 1994, the mother of the infants, Juanita Hoyt, was sentenced to life on five counts of murder. She had smothered, killed all of her five infants. So the entire paper was actually based on infanticide and not on sudden infant death syndrome. Back to Ganterot, who proposed this mechanism, in his book published in 1989, previously to the discovery of Juanita Hoyt being the killer, he wrote that the infants in the Stein-Schneider article were documented polygraphically, which means having a proof, as having episodes of prolonged apnea with cyanosis, some requiring vigorous resuscitation. The next slides are what the police found in the emergency unit, and comparing the notes made by Steinschneider and the notes made by the nurses. On June 30, Steinschneider writes one prolonged apnea. The nurse wrote, the alarm went off, but the baby was breathing. In other words, there are a lot of false alarms. The alarm goes off, but nothing happens. On July 1st, Steinschneider writes three prolonged apneas. The nursing notes read, apnea monitor went off at 10:55,
but child was sleeping and breathing. The alarm off once, baby was breathing. On July 2nd, three prolonged apneas, as Steinschneider reports, but the nurses wrote, monitor went off numerous times in the morning, but child breathing. Apnea alarm rang twice, no apnea noted. So he was also falsifying completely all the reports. When Ita Hoyt was arrested and sentenced, someone went to talk to Dr. Ganterot, still very active in the field, and asked him why he had recommended acceptance of the Steinschneider paper. I failed to say that when the paper was submitted to pediatrics, the editor, Dr. Lucy, and Dr. Lucy's name will come back again in a few moments, sent the manuscript for review to Ganterot, who clearly had a vested interest in the matter. And the naive answer by Ganterot was, I thought it confirmed my theory. So if it confirms my theory, I will accept the manuscript for publication, which I think is brilliant. Brilliant and totally wrong, of course. It was along those times that people start wondering about this relationship. And there were a number of studies. Two fundamentals, one were published, one by David Southall in the UK. It examined the occurrence of SIDS in near-miss infants. He studied 800 infants who had a near-miss episode. Only 1.4% died of SIDS, which means that 98-99% did not. Molly Valdez-Lapina was one of the best pathologists in the United States. She was working in Miami. She looked at the documentation of apneic episodes among 800 SIDS victims and found that only 5% of them had apneic episodes. At this point, NIH sponsored a huge study to assess with apnea monitors and with monitors the occurrence of apnea in infants at increased risk for SIDS and prematures. This was published in one of the leading journals in medicine, JAMA, in 2001. And I will read to you some of the data. The objective of the study was to test the hypothesis that preterm infants and siblings of infants who died of SIDS and infants who have experienced an idiopathic, apparent life-threatening event, such as a near miss, have a greater risk of cardiorespiratory events than healthy term infants. By cardiorespiratory events, it was meant prolonged episodes of apnea, of not breathing. They studied more than 700,000 hours of home monitoring in more than 1,000 infants. Events exceeding the conventional alarm thresholds occurred in 41% of the infants, so very commonly. And in 10%, they were extreme events. However, there were only six SIDS victims, six in 1,000. And in none of them were cardiorespiratory events recorded. So a complete dissociation between the two things. The conclusion of this study, called the CHIME, was that conventional events are quite common, even in healthy term infants. Extreme events were common only in preterm infants, and their timing suggests that they are not likely to be immediate precursors of SIDS. This very important article was accompanied by a very significant editorial by Dr. Job. And this editorial is so important that I've made a few slides of it. It starts by recalling that a home monitoring industry with the noble goal of preventing sudden infant death syndrome has now operated for many years without either a sound scientific foundation for monitoring or a clear demonstration that monitoring decreases sudden infant death syndrome. In the United States, about 20,000 preterm infants are sent home with monitors each year. The cost of monitoring alone, not including ancillary medical costs, is about $24 million per year for the preterm infants. This cost does not include monitors for term infants, the normal babies, thought to be at increased risk for SIDS. CHIME, the study I've just mentioned to you, disproves the assumption that infants thought to be at increased risk of SIDS have more cardiorespiratory events than healthy infants, and is consistent with the conclusion that such events are not precursors of SIDS. The study was not designed to test the utility of monitors to prevent SIDS, but as a result of the study, the physiological basis for such a practice is more in doubt than ever. This study justifies a severe curtailing of home monitoring to prevent SIDS. It was a sort of gravestone for the apnea monitors, or should have been. Well, now we change a little bit, and on the theater or scene of SIDS, in 1973, enters young Peter Schwartz. And the number three keeps recurring, born in 1943, it's 1973, 2013. Okay. So why did I enter? I entered for a series of circumstances. I entered and developed what has been subsequently called the cardiac hypothesis, but my initial reasoning was that in the Western world, the leading cause of death for men aged 35 to 65 is sudden cardiac death due to ventricular fibrillation. Ventricular fibrillation is an arrhythmia such that your heartbeat, which usually is 60, 70 beats per minute, suddenly goes to 500. There are small contractions at that speed. The heart is unable to pump blood in the arteries. Blood pressure goes to zero, and if there is no resuscitation within a few minutes, there is irreversible brain damage and death. And my question was, well, if this is the leading cause of death in adults, is it possible that it doesn't happen in some infants? It would be very strange. And for this reason, in 1976, I wrote in the American Journal of Medicine a hypothesis and suggested that a certain number of sudden infant death syndrome deaths might be due to a lethal but preventable cardiac arrhythmia possibly related to the long QT syndrome, and I will mention it now. The critical issue was that my interest was because I thought of something that might be preventable. I'm not interested, quite frankly, in things that cannot be prevented. I mean, there are so many wonderful things to do during the day, time with the family, golf course, whatever, and why should I work on something that cannot be prevented? If it's not preventable, someone else will deal with it. I'm interested in preventing things. Okay, how did it all start? It started, as you see, by, this is the leading newspaper in Italy, and it was October, mid-October 1970, when this girl, 19-year-old, died suddenly in a quiz program in television. In those days, in Italy, there was only one TV channel, in black and white, and everyone was watching the TV because it was a big thing, and this quiz program was very famous, very important, so everyone was watching it. During that program, the anchorman asked a question to this girl sitting in the audience, and she died on the spot in front of everyone. The post-mortem was negative, but the mother, who had only elementary school degree, was much more intelligent than the physician surrounding her, and she realized that the daughter who died suddenly had had a peculiar history. She had been fainting since age 3 any time she was getting emotional or frightened or was running. She was dropped on the floor, and for a few minutes she was out of consciousness. And when this one died, she realized that among her 11 children, there was another one, 9-year-old at the time, by the name of Agostina, who had exactly the same pattern. Anytime Agostina was running or being frightened or questioned at school, she would drop on the floor. So she took the little girl to Milan, to the university, and by a combination of events, it ended up in one of the four bands where I, as a green doctor, completely a rookie, not knowing a single thing, had some responsibility with senior doctors. So I had to take care of her, and we had no idea what she had. It's a long story, I'll make it short. We made the diagnosis of this long QT syndrome, and I will come to some details in the moment. As I mentioned in the QT, word QT, let me remind you that the electrocardiogram has waves that are defined by letters of the alphabet. And there is one wave called Q and another wave called T. This is the time of what we call ventricular repolarization or recovery from an electrical point of view. This interval can be measured, can be quantified, as a certain normal value in normal people, which is around 440 milliseconds. And in patients with the long QT syndrome, this interval is much more prolonged. So when I talk of long QT, I mean that on the electrocardiogram, which is something, a tool that is easily available to everyone, one would note a major prolongation of this interval. What is the long QT syndrome? It's a genetic disorder, so it's genetically transmitted. It manifests in young age, age 3, 5, 7, but also in the first few months of life. It's characterized, as I just said, by a prolongation of this electrocardiographic interval. From a symptoms point of view, from clinical events, these children or teenagers have syncope, which is a loss of consciousness, or cardiac arrest, especially, but not only, but especially during emotional or physical stress. These are the children who die suddenly playing hide and seek, or swimming, or when they are at school, or when the parents suddenly yells at them, whenever they are emotional. Some of them, however, die also during sleep. And there is a very high mortality among untreated patients. Now, what makes the disease important is that we have very effective therapies if we make the diagnosis. This slide comes from one of my studies in 1985, so a long time ago. At that time, I was able to get specific information on 233 of these patients. And what we did, the patients who all had at least one episode of loss of consciousness. And knowing the exact time of that episode, we called that time zero. So we looked what happened in terms of survival between patients who were left without treatment or treated in a variety of improper ways. And what you see is that within 1 year, 1 year from the first episode, 21% of them died. And mortality goes on over time to be approximately 50% in 15 years. Now, the average age at time zero was 14 years. These are children. Average age of 14 means that you had kids or infants of 2, 3 years old or 25. Look at this. This was the curve in 1985 for those patients treated with beta blockers. Beta blockers are a very common drug that block the effect of the sympathetic nervous system activation on the heart, or by sectioning some of these nerves. Mortality was down to 9%. What about 2012? Mortality is down now to approximately 1%, which means that now we can save 99% of these patients with proper treatment. Now, the critical issue is that you can treat only patients after you've made the diagnosis. And I will come back to that in relationship to sudden infant syndrome in a moment. Why I thought that long QT syndrome and SIDS might have had some connection? Well, long QT syndrome patients may die in the first year of life or later, but also certainly in the first year of life. In 12% of cases, sudden death is the first manifestation. So it's the first event that kills. Of the patients who die suddenly, 68% never had any symptom. The post-mortem is completely negative, exactly as in sudden infant death syndrome. The diagnosis based on the electrocardiogram is relatively simple, and very effective therapies is available. So that is a very critical issue. So based on, this is just an example. This was the first case of Romano Ward. Romano was an Italian, Ward was an Irishman who made the first description of this disorder. And this was the very first case in the first year of life. So it's 3 months old little girl who had a number of episodes of ventricular fibrillation, and she eventually died because they had no idea on how to treat her. Anyway, we are now, in terms of time, in the fall of 1973, and I was leaving Italy to go to work for 2-3 years in the United States, in Texas, and while reading scientific journals, I learned that NIH, which is important funding agency, was making what was called an RFA, request for application. They had money that they want to give to people doing research on sudden infant death syndrome. Quite frankly, in 1973, I had no idea of what sudden infant death syndrome was. So I started looking and reading, and it seemed to me that there were a number of points in common with the long QT syndrome. So I put in a proposal to explore the possibility of a relationship between the two disorders. This was actually the front page of the proposal, which was funded by NIH. So I was the first investigator in Italy to come back with money from the American government. I have many points of view different from the American government, particularly during the last 10 years. But nonetheless, I'm very grateful because for the last 40 years, they have supported my research in a wonderful manner. And being funded for this research helped me when I returned to Italy to work in complete independence, which for a very young doctor in Italy in those days was very unusual. I didn't have to ask permission to anyone. I didn't have to ask for money to anyone. I didn't have to go to the boss or professor to ask, please, may you buy me this piece of equipment. I had the money, so I could do what I wanted, and I did it. So part of the hypothesis I had was that the way to test it, I mean, the idea was that some infants dying of SIDS, in my opinion, might have had the long QT syndrome, a treatable disorder. How do you prove? I mean, to make a hypothesis, everyone can make a hypothesis. The question is that the hypothesis must be feasible. You must be able to test your hypothesis. In our case, or in my case, a large population of infants, that's what I wrote, will have to be studied for QT interval, measuring the QT interval, and heart rate, and followed prospectively for sudden infant death syndrome. In those days, the incidence or prevalence of sudden infant death syndrome was between 1 and 2 per 1,000 live births. So the only thing I could do was, as my plan, to record the ECGs in a lot of infants. My children were part of the study, by the way, and my grandchildren now as well. And then to wait, because unavoidably 1-2 per 1,000 would have died of SIDS. It took me 18 years to carry on the study, and I was discussing with Bongani earlier on. Meanwhile, I was doing other research projects. I mean, sudden infant death syndrome is one of my main 4 areas of work, but it's not the only one. Because this study was carried out without funding. No one wanted to fund a 30-year-old researcher with weird ideas with a foreign name in Italy. So it took me 18 years to do the study. I asked a lot of friends in various hospitals, please record the electrocardiograms in the new books and so on. And however, we published it in 1998 on the leading journal in the world, the New England Journal of Medicine, with the Lancet is at the 2 leading journals in the world for medicine. What did we do? We were able to study prospectively more than 33,000 infants. Just imagine 33,000 infants all having an ECG. At the end of the study, 24 of these infants had died of sudden infant death syndrome, and 12 of them had a QTC, a QT corrected for heart rate, that was longer than 440, which is the upper limit of normal. 5 of these 12 actually had a QTC over 460, a very long QT interval. We calculated the relative risk of dying of sudden infant death syndrome according to many of the parameters that were thought to be important, such as smoking in the mother, history of ALTE, which is the same as near miss, prone sleeping position, smoking and bed sharing. Well, as you see, if an infant had a QT that was prolonged, the risk of developing sudden infant death syndrome increased by 41 times. A staggering figure. So one of the conclusions of the New England Journal of Medicine in 1998 was that our results raised the issue of the potential value of routine neonatal screening by electrocardiography. And these really raised a lot of waves. What you see here is what Dr. Lucy, still the editor of Pediatrics, the same man who has sent Steinschneider article to Gunteroth and published it. He made an editorial after my publication in the New England, and he wrote, "I have been an avid reader and admirer of the New England Journal of Medicine since I was a medical student. Recently, however, the journal published an article by Schwartz et al. And an editorial by Friedman and Tobin complimenting the study. I was dismayed. I decided that the article warranted a forceful critique." So my work was going against anything that they postulated. And he called seven of his friends, cronies, call them as you like, to write something against my work, which I think is all right if he had given me a chance of a reply, which he didn't, which is almost unheard of in science. I mean, I think it's absolutely fine. There is a publication that is controversial. It raises the issue of doing an ECG on every newborn. Perhaps we should challenge that. Fine, but you have to give the opportunity of a response, and they didn't. Well, I didn't stop, certainly, because of his editorial, and 2 years later, in July 1927, year 2000, always in the New England Journal, we published the first evidence of a molecular link between the sudden infant syndrome and the long QT syndrome. What did we do? Because, you know, the first publication I had in this journal, which is so difficult to publish, required 33,000 patients. The second one, one. But it was important. That's why it was accepted. What happened was that in a city in northern East Italy, a 44-day-old infant who was in good health was found acneic, not breathing, and cyanotic by his parents. The good part of the story is that his family was living at 100 meters from the hospital. So the father rushed to the emergency room with the little one in his arms. They made an electrocardiogram and attempted CPR. When they made the electrocardiogram, what they saw is this, and without entering in any detail, this electrical activity is a marker of ventricular fibrillation. At this speed of electrical activity, no blood is pumped out. Well, at that point, they defibrillated the little one, as you see in a movie, counter-shocking, went back to life. They looked at the ECG, and the ECG, as you see, had a tremendously long QT interval. So at this point, it would seem, you know, this is just a case of long QT syndrome, dying very early. We have had them before. These doctors were clever enough to send me the blood of the child, and we went from the blood to DNA and looked for genes responsible for the long QT syndrome. We found that that's a baby. Had a genetic mutation in one of the genes responsible for long QT syndrome. The parents had a completely normal QT interval, and they did not have the mutation. So this was what we call a de novo mutation, a mutation occurring during pregnancy. By the way, we did the paternity test, which is essential because the reality is that all over the world, 6-7%, which is a staggering number in my opinion, of kids are not sons of their father, but I will not elaborate on it. It would take us. But it's a consistent finding all over the world. I mean, it's no matter the country, the religion, 6-7%, which I think is interesting, to say the least. In any case, the father was a father, and if the baby had died, and one would have suspected the long QT syndrome, one would have had an ECG on the parents, and there was nothing. Totally normal. So no one would have thought about long QT syndrome. The fact that the baby survived by sheer chance and that we found the mutation was the first evidence that his baby had had a cardiac arrest because of the Long-QT syndrome. Under any circumstances, if the baby had died, he would have been labeled as a classic, typical sudden infant death syndrome case. This infant survived. But, you know, if you come up with a finding like this, you would expect people interested in the area to be happy. There was something absolutely amazing. Now, note the dates. July 27 is when the article was published in the morning. The same day, at 5:13 p.m., SIDS Alliance comes out with a press release. What is SIDS Alliance? SIDS Alliance is the most powerful and more widespread organization of parents that get together to help other parents who have suffered sudden infant death syndrome, promote meetings, research. So these are good people who had a tragedy to go through such an event. And someone sent me this press release where I read, the majority of babies with Long-QT syndrome remain perfectly healthy. Perfectly healthy. We know that 50% will die if they are not treated. And then the press release goes on and says, it is the only such case in 20 years of study. Now, this has nothing to do with my study of 20 years. It was an independent case. But why? I mean, I was wondering, why is it that the most powerful organization of parents, instead of saying, well done, you found a cause of some of these victims that is preventable, we are glad about that, they attack the publication. So then, you know, you have to find an explanation. I mean, I don't think these people are demented. So I went looking into what's behind SIDS Alliance. And I discovered that SIDS Alliance, this wonderful parent organization that does actually a lot of wonderful things, has one major sponsor. Mr. Pete Petit. So the founder of Healthdyne, the great producer of apnea monitor, whose financial success is based on the apnea theory, as soon as something comes out pointing to another mechanism, immediately challenges. I think that from one point of view it's beautiful in terms of logic, because there is an explanation. At least now I know why I was attacked. But it's also scary. It tells me and you and all of us how careful we have to be when we read certain things. We've got to figure out what's behind. Anyway, I went on, as usual, I mean, sort of stubborn, and 1 year later, in The Lancet this time, we provided the first evidence of a SIDS victim, an infant who died of SIDS related to the Long-QT syndrome. What happened in this case was that a four-month-old infant was unexpectedly found dead in his crib. They made the postmortem, which was negative. They made the diagnosis of SIDS. But the coroner who knew about my work, sent the DNA to our laboratory to look for genes for the Long-QT syndrome. And what did we find? We find that the dead infant, had a mutation producing Long-QT syndrome. We don't have his ECG. We looked to the family. They all have a normal QT. The family members didn't have the mutation. The father was the father. And, okay. So it was an honest family, and no one had the mutation. You might have wondered, I mean, is this mutation really causing the Long-QT syndrome? Well, I have probably one of the larger cohorts of patients in the world, because people come to me for this disease from all over. And we have one of our families with exactly the same identical mutation found in the infant. And the members of this family with this mutation have an extremely long QT. So we could connect the dots. And again, we proved that this infant had the Long-QT syndrome. Now, when I give this type of talks, I always wonder, because it always can be that within the audience there is someone who had suffered such a tragedy. I mean, I don't know, I mean, but it could be present. And I always wonder if there were a mother of a child like this, or the mother in Italy of this child. I mean, very often talks on this subject bring in a lot of people who have had these tragedies. And I wonder if the mother would raise a hand and say, excuse me, but if you had done an electrocardiogram in my infant, in my baby, would you have found that he had the long QT syndrome? And what could I answer? I would have to answer, yes, almost certainly yes. And she would then go on and she could ask me, but excuse me, if you had found that my baby had the long QT syndrome, you might have been treating the child with beta blockers. And I said, yes. And if you had treated my child with beta blockers, my child would have died? And what can I answer? I would have to say, almost certainly not. And then I would expect the mother to say, well then, why no one has told me when my child was born that there is an uncommon disease, 1 in 2,000, that can kill in the first few months of life, that can be diagnosed by an ECG, and that is highly treatable. If I knew that, I would have had an ECG on my infant. So this is one of the critical issues, and this is bringing me toward the conclusion. We had to define what is the prevalence of the long QT syndrome, because no one exactly knew. People say it's a rare disease, but what a rare disease means, 1 in 10,000, 1 in 20,000, 1 in 5,000. We had to know more precisely, going from the two cases I've shown to you that are almost anecdotes, if you take 100 infants who died of SIDS and you look for the genes for long QT syndrome, how many of them had long QT syndrome? So we did such study, and in collaboration with a Norwegian group, we actually studied 201 SIDS victims and compared them to 227 controls, and we found that genetic mutations causing the long QT syndrome were present in 10-15% of cases. This was going from anecdote to evidence in large numbers. So the conclusion was that having demonstrated that 10-15% of cases diagnosed as SIDS carry significant genetic variants in long QT syndrome genes establishes that sudden arrhythmic death is an important contributor to sudden infant death syndrome. So now it's not only no longer a hypothesis, now we know for fact that 10-15% of what we call sudden infant death syndrome is actually caused by the long QT syndrome. As these variants, genetic variants, are likely to modify the QT interval, our results support the debated concept that an electrocardiogram would probably identify most of the infants at risk for sudden death due to the long QT syndrome, either in infancy or later on. So this brings the last part of my talk, the question and issue of neonatal ECG screening, performing an ECG whenever there is a new infant. What will be the implications? Well, with the goal of identifying early on those infants likely to be affected by long QT syndrome, I think I have 5 minutes left or 7 minutes left, by affected by long QT syndrome, ECG screening can potentially achieve the following benefits. Treatment and protection of affected infants from life-threatening arrhythmias, thus reducing long QT syndrome-related deaths in childhood and later on as well. The identification of additional family members, children, teenagers, adults, also affected by long QT syndrome, and thus at risk for sudden death. Now, this is very important. I've shown to you the cases where there was a de novo mutation, but most of long cases of long QT syndrome are familial. You find one, and then you find another 5 or 6 in the family, and they may have not been diagnosed before. Treatment of all infants affected by manifest long QT syndrome could protect those at risk for dying in the first few months of life and whose deaths would be labeled as sudden infant death syndrome. and the identification of a few but life-threatening cases of congenital heart disease not diagnosed during routine medical visits would also allow for timely surgical correction and a radical change in prognosis. But there are some questions that one has to answer before actually proposing. Now, I'm saying this, as you will see in a moment, because I've been discussing with the Minister of Health in Italy during the last 13 years for the possibility of introducing neonatal ECG in Italy, and we are very close to that. But we need to answer two questions. What is the prevalence of long QT syndrome, how frequent it is, and how much does it cost to perform such a screening? I mean, it's easy to say, let's have an ECG on all the babies, but you know, money is not that abundant everywhere, especially now, so how much does it cost? So for the prevalence of the long QT syndrome, what we did, we studied, I told you earlier that my study on the 33,000 newborns took me 18 years. But when we did the next one, and we did it because the Minister of Health said, I mean, you've got to prove what you're saying, and to tell us how many cases of long QT syndrome there are. And I said, fine, I'll do it, give me the money. And they gave me the money, and we did it in less than 5 years, 4 or 5 years. So what we did, we studied with an ECG, this time 44,000 infants, age 15, 25 days old. A second ECG was performed whenever the QT was long. If it was abnormal, we wouldn't just jump to a diagnosis, but we would repeat it. And then in those with a long QT, we would perform molecular screening, the genetic test. Always when the QTC was above 470 and attempting and when it was between 460 and 469. So what did we find? We found disease-causing mutations in 16 infants. There was one infant without genes but who had a very long QT, and we made the diagnosis because also the father had an extremely long QT. Since 17 of 43,000 Caucasian infants, here we look to Caucasians because we wanted to make sure that we were not dealing with genetic variants that might have been race-related. So as 17 of 43,000 infants were affected by long QT syndrome, the prevalence of the disease is at least 1 in 2,500. However, these are the data that we had. And what this pyramid shows is that as we go above 440 is the normal value. So you see that 97% have normal values. And as you go to higher values, the numbers are becoming smaller and smaller. And we found that for these ones with very long QT, 43% had a mutation causing the disease. At this level, between 460 and 470, 29%. But we had not tested this group, and I can't believe that none of these has a disease. Someone must. We are actually tracking them down now. So we don't notice, and based on the non-genotype infants with a QT between 450 and 470, we suggest that the actual prevalence of long QT syndrome is close to 1 in 2,000. This is what I believe is the prevalence of the disease. So we can make it count. This is just an example of a situation where we had an infant, a healthy infant, in whom we found a very long QT. Then we screened the family and we found that the father had a tremendously long QT. So this allowed us to put the father on treatment in time. So there is the issue of cost. How much does it cost? And again, if you raise a question, you've got to try to give an answer. So we made this study, and what did we find? These are really the last few slides. The incremental cost-effective analysis shows that the cost per year of life saved is very low, 7,000 euros. I say that it's low because traditionally it is said that if the cost of life per year life saved is below $50,000, it's very effective. In this case, we were much below. So these are the data that I discussed then with the Minister of Health. What is the situation in Italy? The births per year are 550,000. The prevalence, as we say, is 1 in 2,000. That means that we can expect every year 275 neonates with the long QT syndrome. We expect at least two, to be conservative, at least two relatives to be affected for every neonate with the long QT syndrome, an additional 550. which means that a combined ACG and molecular screening will identify about 825 cases of long QT syndrome every year. What is the cost then? Well, we calculated the cost, and the cost to perform the ECGs is over 5 million euros. And if we include all the additional cost in the analysis to be repeated, and including even treatment up to age 70, there is an additional 1.5 million. So the total cost, again in Italy, is over 6 million euros, which, however, is 12 euros per neonate. Now, one has to place it in relationship to the cost. I mean, even at your home, if you buy something, it may look be expensive in a certain household, less expensive in another, depends on your income, depends on how much you're spending for other things. So the cost in Italy would have been 6.6 million euro per year. In Italy, the spending in 2008 was actually 104,000 million, which means that the impact of the program would be equal to one part of 16,000. It's nothing. Compared to what we in Italy spend for health, to add this program costs nothing. It's one part in 16,000. So, and this is my last slide, because I think that whenever one discusses cost for something like this, the best sentence comes from my good friend Robert Pop Meyerberg, a cardiologist in Miami, an expert in sudden death. He wrote that whether the cost of saving a young life exceeds the economic insufficiency of the screening tool will need to be determined by the people. It's the people that have to decide if this amount of money is worth it or is not. My final slide is actually this one. I think that there is a question of rights and duties, and I strongly believe that the parents of a newborn child have the right to know that there is a disease, uncommon but not rare, that can kill infants or children, that is highly treatable and that can be diagnosed with an ECG. This means that if the parents are aware of this, even if the state does not provide the funds, then it will be up to the parents to decide. I will spend 10 euros, 20 euros, whatever, and do it. I mean, it's the cost of three packs of cigarettes. Why not? It's not invasive, it's not painful, and we can rule out an unlikely but terrible possibility. And if we find that the baby is affected, we can treat him. We've seen that mortality is below 1% nowadays. Now, if the parents have a right, the converse is also true. Neonatologists and pediatricians have a duty. They must inform the parents. And this is my conclusion. Thank you for your attention.
Great.
It was long, I'm sorry for it.
Really good, really good. I'm sure Peter would be happy to take one or two questions. There's a question there.
Do you do ECG on unborn children routinely when they have their last scan? Could you do that?
Sorry, could you repeat the question?
Could you do ECG on an unborn child?
Yes, it is done in certain places and actually... Well, the question is, can you do an ECG before birth on a fetus? Yes, there are techniques that can do that. There are actually some groups that are doing it. We are working together with them. There are some questions on the interpretations, but it is doable. The reality is that infants with long QT syndrome may be suspected, I mean, not infants, fetuses with long QT syndrome may be suspected to have the disease, usually by relatively low heart rate and sometimes by irregular fetal beat. I didn't have time to enter into this, but we now actually have the evidence that also a number of deaths occurring before birth, stillbirths, are due to the same mechanism. which is not surprising, because if you have a disease that can kill a teenager, or a child of 3 years, or a child of 3 months, well, it's not surprising that they can kill also a few days before birth. So that is a possibility, and it could be done.
Once you've established that they've got the long QT syndrome, then do you automatically do a molecular analysis?
Absolutely, yes. And the reason is that in the single patient, if we are absolutely convinced about the diagnosis, we may not need the genetic test. After all, we were making the the first genes, I didn't say that, but were discovered only in 1995, and we were doing good clinical work before then. But we also know that there are a number of individuals who carry the mutation, who are, for this reason, at risk of sudden death, who may not have a very abnormal electrocardiogram. Some of them have a borderline electrocardiogram. Whenever we do a genetic test, first of all, it is expensive and it takes time, up to 6-9 months. But if we identify a mutation that causes the disease, then what we always do, we call in the entire family, because now we are looking not for a mutation somewhere, but for that specific mutation. It becomes extremely inexpensive, and usually within 7-8 days, we have an answer, yes, no. And which means that then we can treat the entire family if they are affected, and we can also provide reassurance for those unaffected. Now, this is a disease that produces many sudden deaths in a family, and is a terrible thing, a terrible psychological burden to grow up in these families and thinking, I also am going to die, I also have this disease, or I may die. Now, with the genetic test, those affected, well, they know that they are at risk, but we can treat them, and very effectively. And also, the siblings who are not affected, we can tell them, you don't have to worry, and that means also you will not transmit the disease to your offsprings, which is another important consideration. Thank you for your question.
Yes, we'll take
that.
Two questions, and then
call it
there. Yes,
ma'am. If your pediatrician tells you that your child has a heart murmur at birth, is that related at all?
No, it's unrelated, and the pediatricians keep telling this to almost everyone. Sorry? Well, you know, it depends on what type of murmur and depends on many other things, but it's unrelated to long QT syndrome. These are totally different things. Now, of course, a cardiac murmur may have sometimes important, depends on the type, characteristics, so usually you do a certain number of things after the first information.
For economical reasons, it's unlikely that all the therapy will be ECG. You already have indicated some of the risk factors which make it possible, perhaps, to indicate. What would your recommendation be? Which of all the therapy people should preferably have an ECG rather than everybody?
Well, this is an important question. Now, clearly, if a SIDS event has already occurred in the family, that would be a major reason to do it. If an infant has had an episode of near miss, as we have discussed before, it's another good reason to do it. But the reality is that most of SIDS cases could have not been identified on something like this. So I would put it up to, well, I'm putting it up to the state to do something, but I'm also putting it up to the parents, because after all, we all, independently of our economic status, do spend money on a variety of things. The cost of an ECG is such a small thing in every country that, you know, you decide on how you use your money. But if you just keep going to a restaurant one night, you have paid an ECG for your child. So it's a trade-off, but I think that if I were a young father and I knew about this, I would, again, not spend my money in something else. I don't know what is the cost of an ECG in South Africa, by the way. What is it, approximately?
Well, about 150 rands.
150 rands, which is more or less the same as in Italy. It's, well, for some persons it may be a lot, but for the majority probably is something that, you know, if you do it once. So again, I think it's up to each of us to decide how we use our time and money and so on.
Very last question.
Yes, sudden death, I know there have been talks on coronary disease and so on, or even patients having a myocardial infarction, a heart attack. Sudden death is always due, or let's say 90% of cases is due to ventricular fibrillation. This is a sort of common denominator. Long QT syndrome leads to ventricular fibrillation and sudden death. Sudden infarct syndrome cases, probably 80% of cases die because of other reasons, and most of them probably are not preventable. But there is this not small number, 10, 15, could be more percent, who die because they have the long QT syndrome. And that is due to ventricular fibrillation. And this is preventable. So this is what I started to say at the beginning. These tragedies are avoidable. That is the main thing.